right?
It's
all,
yeah.
It's still.
It really is.
Yeah. I know it's going to be harder because we're already in the tech.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome. I hope you all had a very good weekend. I hope you saw the email that I sent out with all the readings for the next few days, as the next few classes, and I postponed the test till next week. So it's not going to be this Friday. It'll be next Friday. And if anybody has a scheduling problem with that, just let me know. We can work around that, because obviously I'm the one who changed that. So I know at least in the other class, there was one student who'd already made plans to be gone that Friday, and she is excused. So if you have that, just let me know as well, so we can figure out another time. I'd like to take it. If you do take it, not at the time, I'd like to do it either right before or right after, but just let me know. So again, my fault, but I just thought we weren't quite ready for midterm yet. I wanted to go one more week. But there are too many things I want to cover before we get to that, and I think it'll be helpful, especially because we'll get to the Roman Empire and Christianity when we come back from that midterm, and that makes a kind of nice break, I think. So, Håkon, yeah.
It'll be next Monday.
No, next Friday.
Next Friday.
So it was supposed to be this Friday, right, in two class periods, right. But it'll be next Friday. So the 28th, September 28th. And I'll give you a review sheet probably on Monday of next week to give you, get you ready, at least for partially ready. It's not a full review, but partially. Okay. So anyway, just double check. Make sure you've got that email and have all that down. So I put on there exactly what I want you to read for each class day as well. So for Wednesday, I'd like you to read everything that we have from Aristotle, which I think is just those two readings from the Ethics and from Politics. So go through those. The first in Politics, the part, it's all important, but the first four pages is really the most important part of that selection, where he's talking about the polis and what the polis is and how man is meant to live in community. So focus on that, especially. So the other thing before we get into class that I want to talk about briefly are your papers. So you handed them in, obviously, on Friday. I have a third of them done. I don't have them all done. So I brought in at the end of class, I've got Josie, Elaine, Mary-Kate, Annette, that was in the other class, Elijah, Lauren Hearn, is she in this class? No, she was the other class too. Okay, Anna Kate, right?
Yeah.
Yep, there you are. Thank you, and Sophia. So you guys just make sure that you pick these up on the way up. So what I've noticed, and they were all fine. Nobody did anything less than a B so far. So they're fine, but I want to talk a little bit about what I'm looking for. And this is not a scolding. I just kind of want to remind you of what I'm looking for. So I had sent you that sheet that said what I think is important to look for in terms of style and how you need to approach things. So the first thing I have on that sheet, and it's something that is extremely important to me. So the grammar is all, my grammar is going to be no different than anybody else's grammar, a grammar set. So that, you know, I think there's an objective standard. Style is not quite so objective. But I want you, as I put in that sheet, I want you to really focus on your verbs. And I want you to use very good, powerful, active verbs. I do not like passive construction, and I do not like to be verbs. So was, were, those are one of the reasons we use those. So I'm going to get a little editorial here for a moment, but hopefully it'll make sense. We only use the passive for two reasons, if we're doing it intentionally. Passive is used because you don't want to identify somebody. So mistakes were made, right? So there, it's a kind of slimy political maneuver to do that, to use the passive. But again, this is if you're conscious of doing it. Most of us just do it because it's part of our culture. But the second reason is because you don't really know what you're talking about. And so it's a way of kind of not saying what you want to say. So one of the examples I give on the paper, especially with, in particular, using the passive, if we think about General George Armstrong Custer's death, June 25th of 1876, right? We know that he was killed by Crazy Horse, right? And a whole, and Custer was wrong. He deserved, I'm not sure he deserved death, but he certainly was in the wrong. And there's no doubt that Crazy Horse was in the right on that one. But regardless, you know, imagine if we just said Custer was killed. This is the example I give you on that sheet. Well, we know a few things, but we don't know a lot. And if we say Crazy Horse slaughtered Custer, we have who did it, who it was done to, and how it was done. And so in the same amount of words, you've given me so much more information. And there's an image there I have. So I want you to be really careful, and I am really a stickler about this. So I want you to have a dictionary, I want you to have a thesaurus, and I want you to be really good on your verbs. Verbs make a sentence. It's not your noun, it's always your verb. If you have a good verb, you will almost certainly have a good sentence. In fact, it's very difficult not to have a good sentence if you get the right verb. It's almost impossible to do it unless you're just consciously trying to foul something up. But so I want you to do that. On this paper, because I did give you that in the instructions, I only, the highest grade, if you used, overused those, the highest grade you can get is a B. On the next paper, it'll be a C, and on the final paper, it'll be a D. So I'm really, it's progressive or regressive, however you want to think about it, but I want you to really work on it. I want you to think about it. And I am, so here's one of the hard things for all of us. So we are all, I mean, I assume we're all, everybody, I think we have one Canadian, right? But everybody else is American born, right? Okay, so we all grew up with English, right? Every one of us. Well, I guess probably the Canadian did too, unless they were from the French part. But anyway, so we've all grown up with English. And there's something to English, and I don't think this is bigoted, I just think it's true. There's something to English that no other language has. And that is the English language has always been very, very open to accepting words from other cultures. Now, if we were at some crazy university right now, that would be considered cultural appropriation. But regardless, it's just a fact. English has always been very open to other languages. So we have all kinds of, we have tons, more than we'd ever realize, Scandinavian words all the time. Norse especially is a huge influence on English, more than Latin actually, much more because of how it developed. But Latin, right? We've got all kinds of words everywhere. French, you know, think about one of Tolkien's famous, why do you call it Bag End? Right? In America, we call it cul-de-sac because we've accepted the French, right? But its real name in English should have been a bag end. It's the same thing, right? But we've chosen the French all because of the French invasion, right? And the snooty aristocrats who took over for a bit. So that those, but we've accepted all that, and we do that. And that means for every one of us in this room, we have to learn more vocabulary than anybody else in the world learning their own language. Now, I would say Chinese is probably harder to learn because of the way the characters are structured. Obviously, English is based on a very nice phonetic structure, and it's very accessible. It was meant to be egalitarian. It was a trade language originally from Phoenician. So our Western languages are meant to be for everybody, but that also gives us a real duty. It gives us a duty to know those extra things because we have that. And English is beautiful. If any of you have ever listened to really good English poetry read properly, it's hard to find anything more attractive. I mean, listen to someone, even the best German speaker, reading in German. It's always guttural. And I like German, but it's not pretty. It's exact, but it's not pretty. It's the easiest language to learn because the rules are all exact. You learn the rules, you apply them. French, right? There really are no rules. There's just billions of rules that don't mean anything. So, you know, it's very, and that's true for all the Romance languages, but we see that. So we have that duty. And I, again, I'm not trying to scold or anything. This is just very important, not just to me, but it is to the whole liberal arts faculty. So I want you to be able to do that. And so from this paper on, not this paper, right? This one I wanted to just see where you're at. But for the next papers, yeah, you're welcome to send me anything. You can come see me as much as you want before the papers do. I'll look at any draft, anything you want. So whatever you need. It was just this paper that I wanted to hold off on. So I'll have office hours, of course, and if you need to meet me by appointment, that's fine. Email's fine, too. So, but I really want to work with people in their writing. So maybe it's kind of stupid to do this right after this paper because we're still 5 weeks away now, at least, from the next paper. And I'll try and remind you as we get closer to it. But I do want you to do that. The second thing I noticed, and this is entirely my fault. This is not your fault. This is mine. I had forgotten, I'm so used to using Turabian, and I've been using it since college, that I just take certain things for granted. And I should have pointed this out to you. All the footnote referencing we do is in chapter 17. So that's the style you need to use. So 17, where you can see, if you just, if any of you have it or if you don't, write it down. If you just look, for example, on page 173, you get automatically the difference between a footnote and a bibliographic citation. NB. Always use the N. We don't use the B in here, right? Because you're not, you don't have to do bibliographies for me. You're just using the N. So basically, everything that is 17N is what you need to know, right? And just reference. I'm not going to test you on it, but I'll see it on your papers. So make sure you look through. And it gives, there's nothing you will cite that's not lit. It's outrageous the kinds of things you can cite. Even a work of art, a painting, there's a special citation for it. So all of those things. So just use that and make sure you have that. I would also recommend, and I'm not exactly assigning this yet, but I think it's good, chapters 10 and 11, which are each just like 6 or 7 pages long. Chapter 10 is on writing an introduction and conclusion, and chapter 11 is on writing a sentence. And they're both pretty good. So check those out as well. Okay, so any questions? Yeah, Grace.
Question. I don't know if this would come up again since we're not studying the Hebrews, but how do we cite the Bible?
Yeah, the Bible is actually really easy to cite because you just do chapter and verse. So it's, you know, 1 Samuel 2:10. And then you always, afterwards, I think if I remember right, it's a semicolon, and then you put the translation. And Turabian actually has all the abbreviations for every translation. Not every, but for most normal translations. I don't think it has like the, you know, what are the modern, like, casual ones. But yeah, it's got all the normal ones. So, yeah, Hawken.
And then something for like the Western Heritage Reader, which is like a compilation of various works.
Right.
How do you, which do you
see?
Cite?
For that, you can easily, for the first one, if you're using the same document, you just put it, for example, 1 Samuel as in that, or in the Western Heritage Reader, Hillsdale College faculty, right, comma, date, 2011, if I remember right. Right, so that's, and then page. Okay. And then afterwards, if you don't switch from that document, you just put the page number.
Right.
Right. Okay, good. Okay, everybody clear? All right, so we're going to jump then right into Crito today. And I want to look at what's happening here with Plato. And I love this stuff. I hope you do as well. But we've got to really think about what is it with philosophy and why is this important? So philosophy, remember, is broken into two parts. Philosophy means the love of wisdom. So wisdom, Sophia, right here. And Philo, love, right? Same Philadelphia, city of brotherly love, right? So here we have the love of wisdom for Socrates and for Plato, not necessarily for Aristotle, but for Socrates and for Plato. Wisdom is always about the accumulation of understanding or the connection of understanding. So it's different from knowledge. Knowledge means to know facts. Right? So there are a number of things that I could do. I could take Rachel. And there are all kinds of facts that I could give you about her. I could give you her birth date. I could give you her height, her weight. We could talk about her hair color, her eye color. We could talk about where she's from, what kinds of groups she belongs to on campus. Those are all facts, every one of them. But wisdom is the ability to know Rachel. Not just know the details about her, but to know her. And the same thing is true. Here's Josie's paper. So there are things I could do with this paper. I could measure its weight. I could go through and count the number of words, which I think you did at the end, right? So I could count the number of words. I could go into all kinds of directions. I could take each of the words and see how many letters each word has. What's the average? I could look at her vocabulary. All of those things are facts. But in the end, it's the whole paper that matters. That's what I grade on. I don't grade on the little bits. I grade on the whole thing. The little bits matter. But they only matter. They don't give me the sense of the paper. The paper is a thing in and of itself. So those facts allow me to understand all of this, but it's different. So this is why in the Garden of Eden, the tree of knowledge of good and evil is not a tree of wisdom. It's a tree of knowledge. And good and evil is interesting because there's not a prohibition of understanding good and evil in wisdom, but there is in knowledge. That's something we could spend a lot of time talking about. Because wisdom, as we'll see throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament, is a glorious thing that is always godly. There is no such thing as wisdom properly understood that is not eternal, that does not come from God. So wisdom is this very precious thing, and it is beyond knowledge. So I told the other class this. I didn't tell you guys this, but I got all your quizzes done, and I forgot to bring them. I'm sorry. I had them done the day after you took the quiz right away, and I've got them all recorded. But I had to make a grade book for you, and I cringe. I just cringe every year. I've been teaching now here for 19 years. I cringe every time I make, every year, every semester, every class, I have to make a grade book, because it is against everything I've been brought up with to put a number to you. That, in my family, in my faith, in everything, my education, nobody can be a number. Nobody can be an accumulation of facts. That is almost diabolic to do that. It is very hard for me. So when I, for example, I mean, you'll see, I don't give you numbers. I give you a letter grade. And that makes sense to me. And at the end of the semester, yes, you'll never get lower than what your points are, but you'll almost certainly get higher, because the points don't, it's not what matters. What matters is the whole thing. How did you come to class? How did you involve yourself in class? How did you look at the paper? How did you look at the book? How did you engage the material? Those things are intangible, but they're there. And you know, I'm at 51, I can judge those things, not perfectly, of course. That's why I never knock you down, but I only take you up. But it is, that to me is why in the humanities it is so hard to quantify, so very hard. And yet that's what we do in modern scholarship. And so I've never even been on, what's the program you guys can check your grades on?
Blackboard.
I've never been on that thing. And I never will unless they force me to, right? Which they might. But it's just bizarre to me that we would do things like that. So I understand in the sciences, because you measure, you calculate, that I get. But in the humanities, that makes no sense to me. So I have to do it. Don't get me wrong, I do it. But it is hard. And that is my Socratic, for better or worse. That's my upbringing. That's my understanding of the human person. It's my understanding of things. And it was, thank God, at least from my standpoint, it was very Socratic, even though I don't think any of my ancestors actually read Socrates, but they understood wisdom in all kinds of ways. So when we think about wisdom versus knowledge, imagine this. I know, anybody else a debater besides Rachel? Any other debaters in here? Okay. So I was trained as a debater too all through high school, and it took me a while to kind of get out of that mode of thinking when I got to college, because I wanted to argue everything. And we'll see that here in a moment with Socrates too. But one of the things that, think about in debate, you do point one, subpoint A, subpoint B, subpoint C, right? This is, when you outline something, you've got all these things. Well, if we just take my hand for a moment, we go A, B, C, D, E, it is perfectly acceptable not to know what D is and to understand what A, B, C, and E are. We know D exists, we just don't know it yet. It's knowledge we haven't figured out. And therefore, wisdom demands that we act in humility and recognize that we know a D is there, but we haven't found it yet. And that's going to be very hard when we look at Socrates, because one of the things that's so important for him is that we recognize how little we know. That is the beginning of wisdom for him. The beginning of wisdom for Socrates is to understand that we know and we don't understand. So, again, I used Rachel a moment ago. I could quantify her. Again, even saying that makes me cringe, but I could. But I probably, even if Rachel and I stay friends until the end of my life, I probably will never totally know her. I will never know my wife completely. And frankly, I'll never know myself completely, because wisdom demands that we recognize the mystery of a thing, not all of the facts and figures of a thing. So I could even make an argument here, a Socratic argument, why you should never objectify a person. Now, we can make that very political, and it's political everywhere, right? Objectifying, especially think about what's going on with the Supreme Court decision right now about whether to bring in this nominee and make him the next Supreme Court justice. It's pretty clear, no matter what, he did at some point objectify a woman, right? That whatever his sins were, that's a sin in and of itself. And we can make an argument, even beyond a religious argument, why that's a terrible thing. because it doesn't allow for the mystery. It's an attempt to know something that you should not know. And that's wisdom for Socrates. There are certain things you leave to the imagination. It's not everything has to be laid out. And so we recognize that. So think about this. Here's a, I'll give you a very modern example. And sorry to be autobiographical about this. I used to, when I was your age, I loved flying. Loved it. I mean, anytime I could get on a plane. And for my generation, generally flying was not cheap. You had to be pretty wealthy to be able to fly. And it's not like now where everybody, you know, it's like Walmart going along in the plane. It was really a class kind of thing. When I was growing up, so I didn't get to do it very often. But when I did, I loved it. I hate it now, for all kinds, mostly because the TSA, but I just hate it. So I get in the plane, and I immediately think, man, did the engineer really know what he was doing, or she, when they designed this plane? And yeah, what happens? So think about just how complicated and how complex it is for a plane. We're talking about so many million tons that's up in the air. That's outrageous when you think about it, what it's doing. And yet, it's not conquering nature. The same rules that apply to flying today applied when Adam and Eve were alive. It's never changed, right? Unless the fall changed something, so maybe. But, you know, let's just say for argument's sake, it's always been that way, certainly since the fall. These laws don't change. If somebody had figured it out in 3000 BC, they could have flown. But it took for a very long time for the knowledge to be discovered. It was always there. It just took that long. That's what Socrates is saying. You have to recognize that as a human being, you have limitations. And as a human being, you have to recognize everybody else has limitations too. So there has to be a humility, a humbling aspect in the pursuit of wisdom. And knowledge can really derail us, because we often think if we know the facts about a thing, we know that thing. And think about what we do to a thing. Imagine if we dissect a flower to understand what makes it work. We've destroyed the flower. Now maybe it was good to understand how it works, but the flower is no longer a flower. We've broken it. And of course, to break a thing to understand it is, as Tolkien says, to leave the path of wisdom. And that's exactly a Socratic element. So we have to be very careful about how we approach those things. So philosophy is truly the love of wisdom, not the love of knowledge. Knowledge is a means to an end. It is not the end in and of itself. The end is respect. The end is love. So this is what Socrates is trying to tell us. And yet, in almost everything he says, he is also trying to give us a sense about what order is. And remember when we talked about the four virtues, we talked a little bit about justice. And if you've had a chance to read Aristotle, you know that the end of all political community is justice. And of course, we'll see that for James Madison too. But justice is, for the most part, identical with order for Socrates. So in order to understand something, that is to know something, we have to know not only what that thing is. So the tree is only a tree when it fully becomes a tree. It's not about its bark. It's not about its leaves. Those are all things that contribute to its tree-ness. But its tree-ness is distinctive. It's a thing. So we only know when we understand the purpose of a thing, the intensity, only when I know Rachel, who she is, not the facts, but what means something to her. And even then, I won't know her completely. But we have to know what that is. The personality, the ambition, all of those things have to come together. And yet, in all of it, she will never fully be Rachel, ironically, until she dies. And that's part of what Socrates is getting at as well. Right? And that's why he doesn't fear death. He will become fully Socrates when he dies. He's not there yet. He's not been blessed with that. So, and he can't seek death, right? That would be a sin. That would be wrong. But you have to accept it when it comes, and you have to accept it with fortitude, with grace, basically, even though Socrates wouldn't say grace. But you have to accept that. So if you really want to understand Socrates and Plato to the beginning of philosophy, if you really want to understand them, you have to understand love of wisdom, and you also have to understand order. So I sent you yesterday that sheet, the guide on how to look at Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Everything for them is about order. everything is about knowing a thing's place in the order of existence. And that's not just the tree, that's every one of us too. So we're, of course, unique because we have eternal life, as opposed to, and Socrates believes that as well, right? We have that as opposed to the tree, which is an earthly thing. There may be trees in heaven, right? But it wouldn't be this one. It would be a perfect one in some way. So they're always thinking about order. So order matters, not just, and that's the facts. That's, in many ways, it's the accidents. We can determine a lot by looking at the facts, but it's only when we've put a thing in its place that we start moving towards wisdom, right? So knowledge, facts, are a means to an end. By the way, anybody even know when the word fact was invented? We use it all the time. It wasn't until the late 19th century that fact was invented. It wasn't a word. So it's a very modern word, even though we use it all the time. So this word signifies a lot, but certainly it's a modern understanding of how to approach the world. Okay, so I want to start on page 79 here in your reader. And I want us to think about who this character is. So I want you to look at this not just from the standpoint of how do we understand Socrates, but how do we understand the times as well? So the heritage here, how do we get that? So just a couple of background points. Remember we talked about the pre-Socratics, and just that title itself is important. You know, Heraclitus, Thales, Xenophanes. So the pre-Socratics and pre-Socratic philosophy, if we can even really call it philosophy, it's pre-philosophy, but it's going towards it. That really starts in the 500s BC. Right? So remember, the word logos comes about around 510. Socrates does not die until 399. So that's a very long time after the pre-Socratics. And Socrates is only philosophizing for about 10 years. So it's only at the very end of the 400s that he's philosophizing. So philosophy, though it comes from the Greeks, takes a very long time to develop. But almost everybody would agree that the first true philosopher is Socrates. And yet, we also have to understand the context, too. When Socrates is going around and questioning everyone, he is doing so after the Athenians have been defeated in the Peloponnesian Wars. They are a city under military occupation, crazily by three different powers, by the Spartans, the Corinthians, and the crazy part, the Persians. So those three aligned to knock out the Athenians. So think about how different that is from Thermopylae, which was less than a century earlier. Now we have the destruction of Athens, and it's never been rebuilt in any way that would be classical. It's a new thing since it's rebuilding. But I want you to keep all of that in mind. So as Socrates is walking around and he's lecturing, he's basically telling people the reason we lost the war is because your sons didn't have enough virtue on the battlefield. That's what he's telling them. They didn't behave virtuously. And you can imagine what that would be like. Here's a city under military occupation. They can't figure out where they are any longer. They used to be the greatest city in the world. Now they're nothing. And this old guy is walking around telling them, this was your kid's fault, and probably your fault, because you didn't teach your kids virtue. So of course they're going to hate him, right? In all kinds of ways they're going to hate him. He's obnoxious, and he's walking around, and he keeps saying this, and it is very disconcerting for the people. And yet Socrates was a war hero. We know that he was decorated at least twice as a young man when he fought. He fought brilliantly as a young man. He had served in the city council as a young man. He had been one of the leading citizens. So it wasn't like this guy was just crazy and came out of nowhere. He has been there all along, and he has been a part of that community. He's 69, and we're only talking about a community of a few thousand people. This would be like bigger than Hillsdale, but not much bigger than the area of Hillsdale and Jonesville. You recognize everybody, even if you don't know them by name. It's small enough. Same thing is true in Athens, and especially after the massacres that have happened where all the young men have been killed. You've got fewer people in the city, and they're walking around. So here's Socrates, and he brings this up. One other thing before we get into reading him that I want you to note, and this is, I think, hard for us to understand, but Socrates did not believe in writing anything down. He believed that all philosophy had to be done on a personal level. So maybe I could teach a class like this, but I couldn't be a good follower of Socrates and write all the time, because Socrates believes philosophy is personal. It has to be taught directly. So it would be better, yeah, the smaller class you have, the better. One-on-one is best. Maybe one with 17 is okay, right, from his perspective. But it has to be very personal. So it's only Plato who writes all of this down. And then one other guy that you don't need to know for this class, but if you're interested, his name is Aristophanes. He writes as well, but he hates Socrates, so he writes bitterly about him. Plato obviously loves Socrates, and so he has the best here in the way he presents it. So when we get to the Crito itself, when we get to the bottom of page 80 and 81, most likely Plato is sitting here in the jail because he's recording all of this. And he's much younger than Socrates. He's been following Socrates around. Okay, so turn back to 79. Here we have two selections from the Apology. Not a dialogue we read. You will read it in great books. But here we're just looking at a selection. And the Apology is Socrates' defense of himself before the 600-person jury. Basically, he's appearing before their assembly, which isn't really even a viable assembly because they're under military occupation. But these are the Athenians that the Persians are willing to allow to govern everybody else for local control. So he goes in front of these people, and he gives this incredible speech. It's the only monologue we really have of any length from Socrates. So, somebody want to volunteer to read? Yeah, Rachel, thank you. So just start with the effect of these investigations of mine.
The effect of these investigations of mine, gentlemen, has been to arouse against me a great deal of hostility, and hostility of a particular, bitter, and persistent kind, which has resulted in various malicious suggestions, including the description of me as a professor of wisdom. This is due to the fact that whenever I succeed in disproving another person's claim to wisdom in a given subject, the bystanders assume that I know everything about that subject myself. But the truth of that matter, gentlemen, is that certainly this. The real wisdom is the property of God, and this oracle is his way of telling us that human wisdom has little or no value. It seems to me that he is not referring literally to Socrates, but has merely taken my name as an example, as if he would say to us, the wisest of you men is he who has realized, like Socrates, that in respect of wisdom he is really worthless. Would you like me to keep going?
Yes, please.
That is why I still go about seeking and searching in obedience to the divine command. If I think that anyone is wise, whether a citizen or stranger, and when I think that any one person is not wise, I try to help the cause of God by proving that he is not.
Okay, thanks, Rachel. Well read. So Socrates is pretty, we can take him as pretty arrogant here in the way that he's presenting this. Only God is wisdom, and all I'm trying to do is show you who God is. That's what he's trying to do. And I'm trying to prove that you have a false understanding. And if I can't prove that, then fine. We've arrived at wisdom. But I'm going to challenge you every time you say that. So this is, it's not just theological. This is really philosophy. Let's figure out how do we love wisdom. So Socrates says, and this is where it's not arrogant. Socrates says the only reason he is wise is because he knows nothing. Now, of course, he knows all kinds of things. He got up. He knew how to put his clothes on. He got breakfast. He knows things. He understands things. So it's ridiculous to say he doesn't know something. But he means this in the sense he can never in this world figure out the ultimate mystery of something. That in its beauty and its creation, it is unique. And therefore, it's only in the next world that we will know that. And it's only by knowing God that we will know that. Now remember, what are most Greeks here in terms of their theology?
Polytheist.
They're polytheists, right? So the idea that you have one God is equivalent to saying you're an atheist. That would be the equivalent. One God means no God to the Greeks, because you have to have multiple gods. So Socrates wants to promote his one God. As long as he acknowledges there are a billion others, that's fine. But he can't single out that one and make an extraordinary claim like this. But he does, and we saw that already with the pre-Socratics. But this is, we're now getting far more personal. It's not personal like Judaism or Christianity, but it's far more than what we saw with the Ur, right? Much farther than that. Okay, Rachel, you want to read the next paragraph?
Okay.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, I am your grateful and devoted servant, but I owe a greater obedience to God than to you. And so as long as I draw breath and have my faculties, I shall never stop practicing philosophy, escorting you and...
elucidating.
And elucidating the truth for everyone that I meet. I shall do this to everyone that I meet, young or old, foreign or fellow citizen, but especially to you, my fellow citizens, inasmuch as you are closer to me in kingship. This, I do assure you, is what my God commands, and it is my belief that no greater good has ever befallen you in this city than my service to my God. For I spend all my time going about trying to persuade you, young and old, to make your first and chief concern not for your bodies, nor for your possessions, but for the highest welfare of your souls, proclaiming, as I go, wealth does not bring goodness, but goodness brings wealth and every other blessing, both to the individual and to the state. Now, if I corrupt the young by this message, the message would seem to be harmful. But if anyone says that my message is different from this, he is talking nonsense. And so, gentlemen, I wish I would say, you can please yourselves whether you listen to Aetius or not, and whether you acquit me or not. You know that I am not going to alter my conduct, not even if I have to die 100 deaths.
Okay, so here's Socrates, right? He means this. And he does mean it. He's willing to die for this. So Socrates is, no matter what they do, if the Athenians let him off, he's just going to go do the same thing. He will not repent because there's nothing to repent from his perspective. He has been told by God this is what he does. And so he's doing it. And it doesn't matter if his best friend, Crito, who is his best friend, tells him to do otherwise. Think about how easily Socrates could escape. In fact, it's pretty clear that the Athenians would really like him to escape so they don't have his blood on their hands. He's been a great hero for this whole time. He may have gone crazy now in the last few years, but he's still a hero. And so they don't want to kill one of their own. And yet, what does he say? No, you're going to have to do it. I'm not leaving. So anytime, think about Crito just walks into the jail. Doors open, right? And so at any moment, Socrates could walk out. At any moment, we presume Plato's here as well. That sounds like a pretty nice jail, frankly, compared to what at least we see on TV. Right, so this is a very different kind of thing. And they could have a boat for him and get him out of there at any time. He just refuses to do it because he's been told. So I would like somebody to take the role of Socrates and someone to take Crito and read here. So somebody besides Rachel, who just, Grace, thank you. You can be Socrates. Who wants to be Crito? Thank you, Elaine. All right, so go ahead and start just right there. Here already, Crito.
Here already, Crito? Surely it is still early.
Indeed it is.
About what time?
Just before dawn.
I wonder that the warder paid any attention to you.
He is used to me now, Socrates, because I come here so often. Besides, he is under some small obligation to me.
Have you only just come, or have you been here for long?
Fairly long.
Then why didn't you wake me at once instead of sitting by my bed so quietly?
I wouldn't dream of such a thing, Socrates. I only wish I were not so sleepless and depressed myself. I have been wondering at you because I saw how comfortably you were sleeping, and I deliberately didn't wake you because I wanted you to go on being as comfortable as you could. I have often felt before in the course of my life how fortunate you are in your disposition, but I feel it more than ever now in your present misfortune when I see how easily and placidly you put up with it.
Well, really, Crito, it would be hardly suitable for a man of my age to resent having to die.
Other people just as old as you are getting involved in these misfortunes, Socrates, but their age doesn't keep them from resenting it when they find themselves in your position.
Quite true. But tell me, why have you come so early?
Because I bring bad news, Socrates. Not so bad from your point of view, I suppose, but it'll be very hard to bear for me and your other friends, and I think that I shall find it hardest of all.
Why, what is this news? Has the boat come from Delos, the boat which ends my reprieve when it arrives?
It hasn't actually come yet, but I expect that it will be here today, judging from a report of some people who have just arrived from Sunium and left it there. It's quite clear from their account that it will be here today, and so by tomorrow, Socrates, you will have to end your life.
Well, Crito, I hope that it may be for the best. If the gods will it so, so be it. All the same, I don't think it will arrive today.
What makes you think that?
I will try to explain. I think I am right in saying that I have to die on the day after the boat arrives.
That's what the authorities say, at any rate.
Then I don't think it will arrive on this day that is just beginning, but on the day after. I'm going by a dream that I had in the night only a little while ago. It looks as though you were right not to wake me up.
Why? What was the dream about?
I thought I saw a gloriously beautiful woman dressed in white robes, who came up to me and addressed me in these words, Socrates, to the pleasant land of Phthia, on the third day you shall come.
Your dream makes no sense, Socrates.
To my mind, Crito, it is perfectly clear.
Too clear, apparently. But look here, Socrates, it is still not too late to take my advice and escape. Your death means a double calamity for me. I shall not only lose a friend who I can never possibly replace, but besides, a great many people who don't know you and me very well will be sure to think that I let you down because I could have saved you if I had been willing to spend the money. And what could be more contemptible than to get a name for thinking more of money than of your friends? Most people will never believe that it was you who refused to leave this place, although we tried our hardest to persuade you.
But my dear Crito, why should we pay so much attention to what most people think? The really reasonable people, who have more claim to be considered, will believe that the facts are exactly as
okay. They are. Okay, that was wonderful. Thank you. Excellent. So, let's talk about this for a moment. We automatically know Socrates can leave. We know that Crito, and you've got to feel sorry for Crito, but the best friend, come on, I don't want you to die, and Socrates, you know, you fool, you really care what other people think? Right? I mean, this is... There's really a kind of... He's not treating his friend that well, but he is, in a sense. So what do we get from this? Just think about the whole... Why is Socrates so confident right now? At least at this moment. Not in the apology, but here in the Crito. Why is he not worried about dying? Yeah, Jack.
He feels like that in death he'll be like kind of in a better place.
Okay, why does he think that? What's happened here that we see?
Because... Well, first off, like, they've been taken over. And
yeah.
Also, like, he isn't able to, like, speak what he believes.
Yeah. What's happened to him personally? Just in the scene we had here.
Had a dream.
Yeah, he had a dream, right? He had a dream. And what happened in that dream? A lady in white robes, most beautiful woman he's ever seen, appeared to him in a dream and said, "Do not be afraid, Socrates. In 3 days, you will be in the land of Phthia. You'll be in heaven. You'll be with your ancestors. All will be well." How do we take that? Before you took this class, did you think of Socrates as relying on his dreams? Is that what you thought when you thought of Socrates? When you think of Greek philosophy, did you think that women in white were going to be showing up? Don't we always think rationality? This is the most irrational thing, the most anti-rational thing that could happen. He's had a dream, and that dream's true. A woman came to him. Now, I want you to just think about that for a moment. How bizarre that is. How mysterious it is. Not at all what we think of Greek philosophy. And yet, isn't it a connection to the divine in some way? A love of wisdom and understanding? And where else in history do we see white women, or women in white, I don't mean white racially, but women in white, where do they appear?
Mary.
Mary is one, right, all the time, right, supposedly, people say. Where else? Think about some of our legends in Western civilization. Anybody know the Arthurian legend?
The Lady of the Lake,
right, comes out, and this is one you probably don't know, the Sioux, Lakota Indians. They believe that at the beginning of all things, the white buffalo woman appeared to two men. One man lusted after her, and she destroyed him immediately, just sapped him, turned him into dust. The other respected her as a goddess and a woman, and she gave him the laws by which all the Lakota lived. Now, there's no reason in the world at all why Christians, at least Catholic Christians and Orthodox Christians, why pagans, why Arthurians, Celts, and why the Sioux, and there are actually other examples of it as well, have this same image. It is truly, I don't have an answer for it, but I want you to understand, this is weird, and yet it's amazing. And it's the crux, he's fine now. I'm going to be fine. Right? I've been told. And think about the religious symbolism for a moment. How many days? Three. Sound familiar? Right? This is 600, written 500 years before Christ. But you've got that symbolism there. That's absolutely fascinating. And one of the great questions, you guys will have to debate this, it's what your second paper's on. One of the great questions, was Socrates a Christian before Christianity? The early church debated this all the time. And remember what we talked about. all of those Stoics who encountered Christianity rejected it initially because of the story of David. Because they said, we've got Socrates and he's better. And frankly, on paper, it does kind of look that way, right? Socrates doesn't betray his best friend. He doesn't betray his marriage. He seems to live a pretty virtuous life. So, and he's going to die for it. And that's really important as well. So let's end with this today. I want you to look on page 87. And this, I cannot stress how important this is. This is maybe one of the most critical things we will talk about this semester. This page right here, in the dialogue from Socrates' first comment to about the middle of the page. This is the first time that we have in writing in the Western tradition an objective belief in truth that cannot be changed. Socrates tells us, if something is true, you can forget it, you can ignore it, you can mock it, you can distort it, but no human being has the power to destroy it. Because if it's true, it's true. And if it's true, it's just as true for Tommy right now as it was for some tribal king in Botswana 1,000 years ago. And it's just as true in Hong Kong today as it is in Mexico City. It does not matter. And think about, did you guys catch this? Socrates says, this was earlier in what Rachel read, right in the middle of page 80, I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're Greek or not, if you're my citizen or not. If you are a human, I'm going to challenge you. Now, that may be obnoxious. It's also a compliment. You're all human, and I don't discriminate based on what I see. I know you're human. And therefore, you count. So think about this. Socrates says, this is back on page 87. Do we say that one must never willingly do wrong, and does it depend upon circumstances? Is it true, as we have often agreed before, that there is no sense in which wrongdoing is good or honorable? Or have we jettisoned all our former convictions in these last few days? So we know the state's going to murder me tomorrow, or in 3 days, or whenever it is. Does that change right and wrong? Absolutely not. Does that mean that I can run off and do what I want right now when I said the other day I couldn't? No. If I was right then, I'm right now. That doesn't change. It doesn't matter if they put me down on the ground and start torturing me while I'm alive, if they start cutting into me while I'm alive. It doesn't matter. Morality, for me, doesn't change. Even when they're being immoral, there's nothing I can do to make it more or less moral, except for my choice. That's it. God gives me cancer. Well, I had a pretty good life. I don't have cancer as far as I know. But, okay, I accept it. I can fight it, but I also accept it. If it's my time to go, it's my time to go. God gave me 51 years. That's a pretty good run. So, I praise him for it. This is what Socrates says. My morality shouldn't change because I'm suddenly mad that God didn't treat me the way I wanted him to treat me. Because it remains the same. So can you and I at our age, Crito, have spent all these years in serious discussions without realizing that we're not better than a pair of children? We didn't grow up. Surely the truth is what we have said. Whatever the popular view is. Man, that's hard in today's age. It doesn't matter what they say on Twitter. It doesn't matter what they say on the news. If it's true, it's true. Even if they don't get it, it's true. Whatever the popular view is, and whether the alternative is pleasanter than the present one or even harder to bear, the fact remains that to do wrong is in every sense bad and dishonorable for the person who does it. I have no control over you. You may take me down. You may torture me. But I can respond morally. Even in that pain, I have that ability. And Socrates does. He dies with grace. Crito, yes it is. Socrates, then in no circumstances must one do wrong. Crito, no. Socrates, in that case, one must not even do wrong when one is wronged, which most people regard as the natural course. Apparently not. So tell me one thing, Crito. Ought one do injuries or not? Surely not, Socrates. Socrates says, and tell me, is it right to do an injury in retaliation, as most people believe, or not? No, never. Those are hard teachings. But I'm going to leave you with this. You don't have to agree with him, but I want you to know what he's arguing. He is arguing this. In order to preserve your soul morally, you may never do wrong under any circumstances. And any wrong you do towards the preservation of the good, you have already destroyed the good. It is impossible to do anything that is wrong to attain a good. He does not believe that you can fudge this or do this and end up in the good. There are no exceptions. Good is always good, and the only thing you can choose is your own moral decision. You cannot choose for others. Right? So this is the first time we have an objective understanding of morality and what morality is. We see it in the Jews, of course, but it's tribal, right, for the Jews. Here, Socrates is arguing for everyone. We'll start seeing that with Isaiah, too, but not quite yet for the Jews. Yes, final comment, Rachel.
So is he basically just saying two wrongs don't make a right?
Yes, but he's also saying this, and I will put this in very Christian terms. He is clearly saying, turn the other cheek. There's just no way around it. He's preaching what Christ will 500 years later. So, yeah.
Would Pericles disagree with this?
Who?
Pericles?
Yeah, Pericles would have, right? Because there are times he thinks, for the good of the community, that you have to do wrong in order to get to the good. Yeah. Okay, thanks, everybody. Sorry to take you over. Don't forget, I've got Josie, Elaine, Mary Kate, Elijah, Anna Kate, and Sophia.
Sorry to step
out. No problem. See you later.
Even something like stealing a loaf of bread to feed your family.
Yeah, Socrates is pretty. And that's where it gets really difficult. At what point are you willing to do that? He seems to suggest there is none.
Right.
I'm not. I mean,